specialist May Brussel. And our guest today with May is a friend, Paul Krasner, the publisher of The Realist. And I won't say any more. Okay.
This is from the LA Times.
Yes, we were talking about how the media controls the mind. You know, there's a lot of talk about conspiracies, and I know The Realist is getting a lot of publicity around, and the newspapers all have these copies. And Schmitz was talking about a conspiracy that killed, that tried to kill George Wallace. So the LA Times had an editorial, and I think you ought to read it. It's short, to show how people are completely brainwashed. Just like at the time of the Munich shootouts, the Olympic Games, they happened on a particular day, and the very next day, James Reston for the New York Times said, one man killed President Kennedy, one man killed Senator Robert Kennedy, one man killed Martin Luther King. The violence of 60s and 70s shows up at the Olympic Games. It wasn't even appropriate to bring in what happened at the Olympics with the other thing, but James Reston, the New York Times, the very day after the Olympics, had a story on the past political assassinations that all the violence stemmed. So then the LA Times follows it up with an editorial this week.
Yeah, well, and this is on Schmitz, who has taken George Wallace's place for the American Independent Party. I was suspicious when Schmitz was due to appear on... He kept building it up. He said, I'm going to announce Thursday about the conspiracy to kill George Wallace. And then he kept building it up so that there'd be a larger audience for when he appeared on Face the Nation, I guess it was, on Sunday, which was on CBS television, plus twice on their radio network that day, at morning and at night. And it was clear to me, because I see it through this filter now, that it was obvious that this was being done to discredit in advance the information that's going to filter up about the real facts about the conspiracy by getting a phony conspiracy scare. Then they can get it into people's awareness. Oh, yeah, there's another on the right and there's another on the left, you know, and it provides them with a safety valve not to deal with the facts. All right, this is the LA Times editorial titled Schmitz's Theory. The odd ones who believe that every disaster that occurs in the world is the result of a conspiracy enjoyed a long run on a public stage after the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Mostly a sincere gaggle. That's one of Spiro Agnew's words,
yeah,
isn't it? Sincere gaggle of peculiar personalities, plainly befuddled and deserving of considerable sympathy. They even become altruistic in the process. Others who pressed the conspiracy theory were in a different category. They were knowing manipulators of public fear as a means to tawdry notoriety, which they relished, or to serve other motives, suspect motives. John G. Schmitz, the lame duck Republican congressman of Orange County, fits into the last classification. Schmitz, who is running for president of the American Party ticket, says, quote, the facts indicate, unquote, that the attempt on Governor George Wallace's life resulted from a communist conspiracy whose purpose was, quote, to deny the American people the choice they deserve this November, unquote. Then Schmitz provided the final little flourish. The Nixon administration, he said, is covering up the facts in what? Why, in a conspiracy of silence, that's what. It all adds up to what? To have Schmitz opposing him means that President Nixon's political luck continues this year without a break, that's what. That's an editorial from the LA Times.
But you see, in order to put down Schmitz, they say that people had a long run on the stage. The real truth of the assassination, the best research is going to start coming out. You know, there's other people like myself that worked 8 or 9 years, and it took that long to really get the loose ends and the threads together, you know. And they think we've had an over long run of things, you know. And he called it sincere gaggle and befuddled work, you know. And
you know what I think it has to do? It has to do on one level with a cultural tradition. There's a book out now about how the Viet Cong, you know, have been fighting for so long. You know, what motivates them? And a woman named Frankie Fitzgerald.
Oh, yeah, I read about that.
I met her in New York, and she seemed, you know, she was like a society lady, but, you know, who suddenly gets a tinge of conscience, hangs around with reporters, and begins to, by osmosis, get away from the comfortable status.
And begins to observe herself.
Yeah, so she went to North Vietnam, and one of the things that she says is that the Vietnamese people had a sense not of death so much as relating to the dead, so that a grandparent would have their children, and then their grandchildren, they would have a sense of history, and their loyalty would be to the human race, which is why they're able, not that they enjoy death, but by why they're willing
to
face the possibility of it, because they have a sense of their relation to the earth. Whereas you have somebody in this country like Teddy Kennedy, who is so selfish about his own life that he refuses to ask for the opening of the archives, even though there's no doubt in anybody's mind that he knows, and I know people who he's discussed it with.
Yeah.
As Coretta King has discussed it, they all know, as Ethel Kennedy has discussed it in private.
Or Robert Kennedy, not one of them, would have the courage, you know, to go into this thing. They'd had no...
Because they were more concerned about their own careers. It happens on every level. I mean, we're all guilty of it. I know a reporter who just got a $17,000 a year job with Newsweek. And she got this on the basis of doing a story, for example, on the Whole Earth Catalog demise party in Rolling Stone. Now, Rolling Stone changed around the last two paragraphs of her article so much that people suggested that, and changed the meaning of it so much that they suggested she sue. They said, you have a clear-cut case here that they've changed your writing, they changed the meaning of what you wrote. And she said, yeah, but it would hurt my career if I were to sue Rolling Stone.
So then she gets
the
job at Newsweek.
So she helped perpetuate this misstatement of the facts that she originally presented. So people are concerned about their own careers and their own lives, and we're conditioned to do that in this culture.
Yeah, the security of the job keeps the person from really telling the truth, but it has to come out. There's so much evidence of a conspiracy that eventually it will all come out, whether it seeps or breaks fast one day like the Pentagon things.
Because there's more and more of an epidemic of conscience. It's like Dick Gregory told me that he'll speak at a college and a guy will come up to him from the CIA and says, you know, this is true, and give him information.
Yeah.
And it's done on what May has called the conspiracies based on a need to know. And so when certain individuals, you know, even when sometimes police realize, I remember Luke McKissick in front of several witnesses to me in Los Angeles when I was talking to him about the Sirhan case and CIA. He said, oh, don't give me the CIA stuff. I'll admit that the Los Angeles Police Department has its own assassination squad, but don't give me the CIA stuff. And he admitted it's a matter of fact that all the people there kind of looked in amazement. When policemen begin to realize that their own brother policemen have been killed, not, say, by the Black Panthers, but by their own assassination squads, you know, as they begin to realize this, then they begin to realize the part that they have inadvertently played in a conspiracy without even knowing it.
Yeah, well, the truth is coming out about assassination squads in the Chicago police system.
Mm-hmm.
And California does right from an investigation from top to bottom. It's worse than Illinois, if that's possible.
Do you think I can just picture the impact of just one major police department being opened up and exposed as having an assassination squad. If enough proof could ever prove that, there goes the whole law and order issue in the whole nation.
I think it'll happen.
I don't think the American psyche could withstand a shock like that.
Well, I'll tell you what'll happen. I really think it'll work this way.
They'll say only in America could you come out with that kind of harm.
Yeah. Well, I read in the paper this week on Thursday that a whole group of San Jose policemen were fired right away. There was some scandal in the police department. Every one of them was fired. Well, San Jose police can't have any more scandals because after the shooting of John Smith, the IBM worker up there, and the Citizens Committee watching them, and the minority people watching them, the chief of police was on the defensive. And if there's any more corruption or scandal or murders, the whole thing could open up. So they have to promise, if you don't go into the past, I'll be a good boy now. So that the policemen up there this week were just fired outright instead of protecting them like they used to be. So I think, like, if the exposures come out about the LAPD and the assassination squads and the Glass House tapes comes out, that book about LAPD, they'll be observed by everybody, and nobody will go back into the past, but they'll certainly have to stop killing people on the streets, just like when they found out that the coroner down there, that Brian Stewart, wasn't a doctor or a lawyer, and that he was saying justifiable homicide. Then everyone caught on all of a sudden to what the coroner's office was doing. So from then on, when a citizen is killed, there's a lot of suits going on right now, and heavy citizens committee, when minorities are killed, they'll stop killing them because they won't get away with it because everyone's catching on now.
But there is a phrase that the devil never sleeps. And, you know, this graph from the Los Angeles FBI, who was first sent to Texas, then to Minneapolis, and now has been retired totally for who knows how much under the counter money to keep quiet. But they do it in such a shrewd way that they make it look like a positive thing. You know, that they did it because he wouldn't allow mustaches. So people then sympathized with Patrick Gray and said, good for him for getting rid of that anti-mustache man.
They also covered up this way that Patrick Gray says that Wes Graff down there was disobeying orders because he had a tap on the telephone where he was taking conversations, and that's against the FBI policy because we don't do that. So Patrick Gray looks like, we wouldn't bug anybody, and we'll fire anyone who does. The truth is that everyone who is attached to J. Edgar Hoover at a high level is being kicked out, and that Gray has taken total control of the FBI and was never in the FBI office before Hoover died, but he was the one appointed by Nixon to step right in. And what he didn't say was that the wiretapping, the phone tapping that Graff was doing had to do with hijackers and TWA airplane, and that the conversations that he was interested in was a particular captain of the airplane who was accusing the FBI of endangering the citizens' lives and the pilots' lives regarding a particular hijack case. So that Wes Graff calls the president of TWA and says, you fire the captain. Not that the FBI should make the airplane safe for people, but that guy is squealing on us. Well, it's important to my research because studying assassinations and conspiracies, I also study who gets control after they murder. And I know that the rash of hijackers that we had, and we've talked about this on the Phil station, would slow down once the laws were made that you had control of every airport if you wanted it. And that many of these hijacking cases were Green Berets, government intelligence agencies, and some connected with the FBI. One fellow in the Southwest who was shot worked with Oswald in the FBI. So they could be hired to do a thing.
Who was that?
One of the hijackers that was involved in a hijacking in the Southwest was shot right after the hijacking. He never had a chance to come to trial or anything. And Penn Jones in Midlothian, Texas, ran an article that this particular agent was one of the FBI men that worked with Lee Harvey Oswald when he was in the FBI. And I knew that a lot of these hijackings, like the fellow that took the money to Honduras, the people got their money back. The man was never found, but the law was on the books. Or the one up in Seattle, the fellow from Salt Lake City, there's a group of hijackers that have been in Army intelligence, in the special services, had training with airplanes and so forth. And I feel the money gets back to the sources, and they, in quotes, don't find the hijackers, and that a good percentage of those were provocateurs.
Purpose being?
Purpose being to have a law on the land that you can search anybody or keep anyone off the airport or go to anything you want, so that if you get more into a state of fascism and you suspect somebody of being, say, political, you can also just pull them off the plane and deny them passage from one city to another.
And the citizens think of it as a good thing. They think of it as a protective device. You know, so that they accept repression and police state tactics as a positive thing.
Well, this is what the series of assassinations was in Nazi Germany, the repressive law.
And in Munich, too. I think it's important to know the background of these people. May mentioned to me one of the people involved in the Munich thing, you know, which one was it, the wife of somebody?
Well, the woman that they're looking for is a member of a fascist party in the Middle East. I've watched the Munich thing, and I have about 14 reasons why I think that a particular sect, with Mr. Beck, the chief of police of Germany in this area, who promised to guard, he didn't need the German police, he would take care of this particular area himself and be in charge of security. And he's very strongly aligned with the Christian Crusade, a far right wing party, and elections are coming up, and it hurt the existing group that want to run for office. The provocation, the murders in Berlin, Munich rather, helped the far right wing, and it was very political for their elections here, like we have killings here for elections, and it involved just a few policemen and one policeman being killed and a lot of Arabs. They could have used all that they wanted, and it seemed that they had foreknowledge of this particular thing taking place, and they didn't bring out more guards, and the men that were guarding it saw them climb the wall. And the use of this kind of a provocation, if it was, and it looks, some of the evidence appears that the Munich thing really stinks. And now they've called off all investigation. They said so it wouldn't be an embarrassment to anybody when they found out the boys all died of bullets, or instead of being smoked out or blown out first. And the investigation's been called off, but the elections go on, the fear goes on, and some gain and some lose, and the answers of the discrepancies are never resolved. That's how you get into watching conspiracies, is the actual discrepancies of the bullets, and who fired first, and it was at a NATO base, it wasn't at a regular airport, It was handled as a military operation. It wasn't a civilian matter. And the men could have had a chance to live, maybe, if they'd been sent over to Egypt or somewhere. You know, they didn't. They felt they'd be safer dead in Germany. I don't understand the rationale of that whole thing at all, and the evidence stinks. But what you do get are new laws. Right away, President Nixon says, we'll guard these people in this country. We'll get new laws at the embassies. We'll get new laws, new people at the airports. And you get more, every time you get one of these single murders or a massacre of that kind, you get more police, more laws, less solutions to the problem, and more repression. And so working out with the group that were angry, you get more repression, more building up of hatred in the Middle East, playing the Jew against the Arab, where that situation was resolving itself.
Did I interrupt you before, Bill? You were about to ask a question.
It slipped my mind now.
Well, we were talking about provocations on this show a lot, and one of the things...
About hijackings, is it?
Yeah, right, I remember what it was. Yeah. I was just going to make the statement that I had never looked at hijacking as in quite that way, that it was a means of getting the American public to accept more repression. But I guess it makes sense. It really does. I can see groups of people that disagree with the government seeking to move from state to state to for speaking engagements or for whatever purpose, and being delayed, harassed, in the guise of, you know, being possible hijackers or carrying a bomb or you know, could even go to carrying contraband literature or something.
Remember this guy? I guess it was an FBI man who shot some people on one of the planes. I think somebody from the Ponderosa, or one of the character actors, was on that. And nobody could explain how, with all their electronic equipment, that guy got on with the gun.
You know?
And they just let it pass. And there are so many things happening that people say, hey, what about that? And then there are so many succeeding, hey, what about that, that the government depends on our collective short attention span.
Well, you know, this hijacker in Vietnam who had sent letters, you know, to Nixon against the war, and he was very active politically, and they, in quotes, called him a hijacker, and he shot on the plane. And then it turned out that was a really contrived thing, that last big airplane that was hijacked down in Vietnam. And he was a very political figure, but it was a very quick way just to shoot him right there and say, well, you know, he's hijacking a plane. And nobody questioned.
You've been holding these all this material in your hands the whole hour.
No, I always bring in more material than we cover. We're kind of wandering around today on different subjects. I just brought in some information because the San Francisco Chronicle this week ran another story from United Press apropos of absolutely nothing, and it reads, Oswald's letter from the USSR, New York.
This is the one that somebody bought it and...
Yes, again, I think it's a medical researcher. The man who's buying up all this stuff is that Dr. Latimer, the urologist. And
oh, really?
Yeah. He is
didn't
the Marguerite Oswald told me that he bought the first articles of Lee Harvey Oswald and that he had a connection with Lee and a particular reason to buy up this stuff. And that she thinks he's buying it for the Kennedy family, that he's buying these letters that are sold at the Waldorf Astoria. But the latest letter that was published in the paper said... it was written in 1959 to his brother Robert, and in quotes it said, I will never return to the United States, which is a country I hate. And the letter was sold for $750 at the Charles Hamilton Galleries, and he wrote to his brother, you don't know anything about me. It was written from the Hotel Metropole in Moscow, and he said in the letter, do you know, for instance, I've waited to do this for over a year. Do you know that I speak a fair amount of Russian? I've been studying many months. I have been told I will not have to leave the Soviet Union under any conditions. I will not have to return to the United States, which is a country I hate. And someday soon, in a few years, I will become a citizen of the Soviet Union. It's a very legal process. In any event, I don't have to leave here. I'll never leave. Well, this was over at the United Press this week, Oswald's letter. So I brought in a sample of my research, and the Carmel Pinecone this week has an article of the research I've done and the volumes of material that I've collected and cross-filed. So I reached into the research on Oswald as an agent in the Soviet Union apropos of the letter that was in the paper today to show you there's two sides to this story. You know, that Oswald said, I hate America, because the commission hearing the government printed 26 volumes of evidence from the State Department and FBI reports and Marine records of Oswald. And the particular area that I was interested in was Oswald the person. And when I read this in the paper, that I hate America, I'm going to stay in Russia. That's what he said when he arrived at the hotel in the Soviet Union. But in volume 24 of the, from the government printing office of the 26 volumes I got, volume 24 is a letter printed, it was April the 7th, John McVicker of the State Department, a CIA agent, discussed Oswald's interview at the embassy when he arrived and how he had been prompted for what he should say, and he knew the procedures of renunciation. And this is volume 24. Oswald was very confident and competent, and he walked up to the embassy and he says, "I want to give you some radar information." And he called a news conference, which is printed in volume 26, page 26, volume 26. And he had a news conference when he arrived in the Soviet Union, and he told them that he hated America, that America was unfair to him, and that his mother couldn't get a job and it was oppressive and so forth. And he was going to offer them all of his radar information. He said, "I was in the Marines and I have this valuable radar information, and I'm going to give it to you because I'm going to live over here and America's no good, and I'll tell you all that I know about the radar in the South Pacific." Well, after he has this press conference and says he hates America, he spends a year and a half there, and volume 26, also page 126, has the information about the radar information. But when he wants to come home, in volume 18 on page 185, and he decides he'll return to the United States, he writes a letter dated February the 28th, 1961. And he says, "I desire to return to the United States. That is, if we could come to an agreement concerning the dropping of legal proceedings against me. If so, I will be free to ask the Russian authorities to allow me to leave, and I'll show them my American passport, and I'm of the opinion they'll give me an exit visa." Well, the reason Oswald wanted to drop any legal proceedings is that in the Warren Commission hearings, there's photographs of his top security clearance in the Marines and in the Navy, and that he was with classified material, top classified, top secret. And that his going to the Soviet Union, he made these public announcements that he would give them all this radar information. And that gave a, he became ingratiated to the Soviet Union because he was going to give them this information. But the Americans knew that that was his cover story. When he writes to his brother, holds a press conference, and says, "I hate America, I'll never come back," that's, in espionage language, covert language, a cover story, because he has to prove to them that he has a reason for being there. He can't just say, "I'm a spy, I want to see what you're doing at the radio factory, I want to watch the U-2 flights or the vapor trails." He has to pretend to really hate this country. So he spends a year and a half there, but when he got out of the service, he signed a paper which said he was legally responsible for anything he did while he was in the service, and that if he passed on any secrets that he knew in the service, he was always legally responsible to come back. He never could break that secret, even though he was discharged from the service and he had honorable discharge. So he knew that he was legally held if what he said was true about giving the radar information. So
how does this all balance off against this, this letter he's allegedly written?
Well, the point is that the brother of Lee Harvey Oswald and the newspaper people have articles when he first defected saying, "I hate America." But the Warren Commission hearings and the researchers have compiled, and particularly myself, because I've worked in this area extensively, have compiled all the information that this letter and his news conference was only a cover for him to do spying for the United States in the Soviet Union. And that when he's ready to come home, he doesn't hate America. He never applied for Russian citizenship. And the fact that the State Department sent him the money to come home, met him, in New York, and provided all of his coming home and gave him his passport back, is the other side of the coin, that he is not hating America at all. The newspaper keeps feeding the lone assassin misfit, and these articles seep into the press, so every new generation or someone coming along can reaffirm their idea that Oswald hated this country.
And he did it alone.
And he did it alone. And so just this week, again, they have the need to publish this letter, but if you point out to the United Press the correspondence of Oswald with the State Department and his relationship to them, they don't print that. The press won't relate that.
Well, I guess we didn't get to about 90% of what you had with you today. That's nothing unusual.
That's the way it happens. How about the response to the realist, Paul? How do you think it's going, the article?
Well, the media all know about it. and the Ralph Nader people know about it, and the McGovern top people know about it. So you just get the feeling that they're, what it is essentially is what May has done is opened up a Pandora's box by establishing linear connections between the Watergate and the Tackwood allegations and the assassinations. And the McGovern people, excuse me, only want to go so far. And apparently the Ralph Nader people only want to go so far. They might do with the funding aspect of it. But people know, and it kind of is filtering up. It's like, I know that in The Realist I ran an article on the concentration camps in America that Look magazine published 2.5 years after that. And
it takes a while to catch up.
Yeah, but I think things are getting speeded up faster and faster, and with the talk shows that are on the air and people calling in and people knowing, I'm feeling a little bit optimistic, at least that when Phil started off by saying, will the truth get out? The truth is out, it's just, will the truth be published?
It was published in The Realist. Well, this lawyer in Washington, D.C., his name is John Bansoff III, and he has filed a 28-page application in the United States District Court for an impartial, unbiased prosecutor in the Watergate case. And I sent him a lot of information this week. He is saying he's the first lawyer, private citizen, to say that Democrats as well as the Republicans can't get to the real motives or the information. They're both going to make deals, the implied, you know, like with each other. They won't do it. And here's a member of the bar filing an appeal for something to open up. So maybe we'll see some more information coming out.
Okay, we're just about out of time. I want to cover a couple points. For people in the Monterey Bay area, at least on the Monterey Peninsula side of the bay, you can get copies of The Realist. Got some more copies brought in at Thunderbird Bookstore out in the valley, Carmel Valley. And here at KLRB, we have more copies. So if you want to drop by, a lot of people have, and we haven't had copies because we just ran out. The demand exceeded the supply in the good capitalistic sense.
Or they can get a subscription because May's already working on Watergate 2 for the next issue.
And it's only, what, $3 a year?
Yeah.
Santa Cruz Bookshop has.
Barely covers the mailing costs, probably. $3 a year. Doesn't sound like much. What about the newsletter? Is that going to come out?
Is it okay to give the address for the subscription?
Go ahead.
It's $3 a year, and just say start with issue number 93, which is the current issue with May's article, and or $5 for 2 years. And the New York circulation office of The Realist is 595 Broadway, New York 10012.
I should give it again.
Yeah, it's The Realist, 595 Broadway, New York 10012. And of course, while material on assassinations and Martha Mitchell and the Watergate might be offensive to some people, other material in The Realist is offensive to other people. So if you subscribe and then you decide to cancel, please be sure to include your zip code.
Okay. A guest and last speaker, Paul Krasner, the publisher of The Realist and a friend, I think, of everybody at KLRB and Mays, and Mae Brussell, political research specialist. We'll be back with edition number 80 of Dialogue Conspiracy next week. It's the same time.
I want you to know I listen to the music on KLRB when I'm editing The Realist.
Okay.
Thank you, Paul. This has been Dialogue Conspiracy, a public affairs presentation of KLRB News. If you have questions that you want answered on future programs, or any comments, write Dialogue Conspiracy, KLRB, Box 3904, Carmel, California, 93921. I'm Phil Kogan.
afternoon. It's 5:05 on KLRB FM in Carmel. It's time for a little bit of brief news in the afternoon. Dialogue Assassination, or excuse me, Dialogue Conspiracy will be on again next Saturday afternoon at 4 p.m., so do come back. Right now, on the California scene, a woman minister in Santa Monica has started a drive to replace the Star Spangled Banner with a less violent national anthem. The Reverend Sue Sinking said she will start circulating petitions in connection with the 28th anniversary of her church, Unity by the Sea. Reverend Sinking explained in these words, "The national anthem of the United States should remind us not of rockets and bursting bombs, but rather of freedom, justice, and brotherhood." She said, "My country, 'tis of thee, America the beautiful, and God bless America would be acceptable alternatives." Let's see, and Governor Reagan came out today in support of Proposition 2, a measure on the November ballot to allow expansion of health science facilities at the University of California. Reagan said the bond issue would provide for the training of doctors, dentists, and nurses, and other health care improvements as well. The act would provide $156 million to build new medical schools on such campuses as University of California at Irvine and University of California at Davis. Let's see. State Controller Houston Flournoy charged today that the Watson tax initiative would cause either a 15%